From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And today, Democrats begin to make their case for why President Trump should be removed from office. At issue is whether the president obstructed Congress and abused his office in withholding military aid from Ukraine and asking that that country's leader investigate the Bidens. Last night, during a bitterly divided session in the impeachment trial, Democrats failed to get any amendments passed to subpoena new witnesses. But today, the Senate Minority Leader, Democrat Chuck Schumer, called on Republicans to allow witnesses when the issue comes up again.
Senate Republicans have the power in their hands to make it a fair trial. Will they use it when it matters? The next real test will come after Q&A, when we revisit the issue of witnesses and documents.
Franco Ordonez is NPR White House correspondent. He's in Washington and joins us now. Hi, Franco.
Hello.
So let's start with the issue of witnesses. When does that come up again? And where are we on the question of whether Democrats will have enough votes from moderate Republicans to actually hear from witnesses?
Well, it could come up again next week after each side gives their opening statements. And as you note, there is a lot of attention on those moderate Republicans such as Susan Collins of Maine, Mitt Romney, Lisa Murkowski, and whether their views can be changed enough or colored enough to then take up and join Democrats in calling for witnesses such as John Bolton, the former national security advisor, and Mick Mulvaney, the acting chief of staff.
And maybe even the Bidens, right? It sounded like today Chuck Schumer, the minority leader, kind of left open the possibility that the Democrats would allow that kind of witness testimony.
They are very interested in getting witnesses, and I think they're trying as they can to give as much leverage as they can. And that's what I think you're seeing from Chuck Schumer.
So how are the House managers laying out their case in the next 3 days now that they have the floor?
Well, they will outline their case that, you know, President Trump abused his power and obstructed the congressional inquiry. We'll likely see text messages again of the conversations between diplomats raising concerns that the administration was pressuring Ukraine for political gain. And as we just noted, the Democrats are going to continue to push very hard for new evidence and ask and try to get Bolton in the side, get Mick Mulvaney here. And they also want more documents.
After that, the defense, the White House, will have 3 days. Will there be opportunity for rebuttals from the other side during those sessions?
Well, they had that opportunity yesterday. That was where they had the chance to kind of respond immediately. But once opening statements are underway, really each side will separately make their case, and the senators will essentially have to sit there for those days until their turn comes up, until the other side comes up. And that's when their chance will be to rebut the earlier testimony.
Let's talk about that. The senators all have to sit in that chamber and listen for hours. Yesterday, it went for more than 12 hours. There were a couple of breaks. They're apparently not allowed to have coffee in there, only water and milk. But they can't talk. They have to focus. Is it possible that minds will be changed in a situation like that?
I mean, it is hard to imagine minds will change. Certainly, they are going to do their best, and they're going to not only be speaking to the members of Congress, to the senators, but they're all going to be, you know, speaking to their constituents back home. And the senators are going to be, you know, listening and to their constituents back home. And the hope for Democrats is that they will provide as a compelling case for those moderate Republicans that we mentioned before to convince them to seek additional testimony. But at this point, it does seem likely that, you know, these positions are pretty hardened.
Franco, as you know, President Trump in Davos, Switzerland today gave a press conference this morning. He repeated his claim that the impeachment is a hoax. What are you seeing in terms of the White House response to what's been happening in the trial?
Yeah, I mean, the president's message is what it has been, a witch hunt, a hoax, as you note. His team is basically carrying that message in the trial. Both his lead attorneys, White House counsel Pat Cipollone and Jay Sekulow, his private attorney, are calling this, saying this is about politics. They say the Democrats not only want to overturn 2016, that election, but also interfere with the 2020 election. That's just a months away now.
Do we have any sense, by the way, of whether the White House is upset that McConnell was not able to get his original plan through of having these marathon 12-hour days?
So we do know that the White House was interested in, you know, having this quick, you know, a quicker turnaround. They did not want this to go into the weekend where their case maybe not get as much coverage. Mm-hmm. But we're still learning what their strategy is. But this was definitely, you know, a loss for the Republican side and a little victory for the Democrats, mm-hmm. though they did not get what they wanted on those all those amendments.
Franco Ordonez, NPR White House correspondent, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, did you know you can watch the impeachment trial right there in the gallery? Anyone can. You can either try for guaranteed seats from your senator or take your chance waiting online. And our next guest did both. You see, we reached out to Oregon Democratic Senator Jeff Merkley's office to see what they were doing with the tickets that every senator receives. They're prioritizing theirs for teachers and students. They have three tickets every day. They rotate them out every 90 minutes. And two of them went to constituent Mary Finn, a former high school teacher from Portland, Oregon. Hi, Mary.
Hi, how's it going?
It's good. And she brought her godson, the self-described politics geek, 14-year-old Aiden Hollinger Miles, a freshman from Oakland, California. Hi, Aiden.
Hello.
And Aiden, I want to start with you. What did you see? What was it like?
Wow. I saw all 100 senators of the United States federal government.
Yeah?
And it was insane.
How close were you? How did you feel like you were in the room where it happened?
Definitely. I was probably 35 feet above Elizabeth Warren, and it was very intimate. I could see everybody. I knew exactly who everybody was in that room.
Well, Mary, I think you told us that you could see the notes they were taking.
Oh, yeah, well, we could see down on their notepads or not taking. So we saw some people taking notes and some people's notepads were empty.
Well, I want to find out more about how this happened. But, what you know, Mary, tell us about the feeling in there. You also went to the Clinton impeachment trial.
I did. Yeah, that's how I knew I could try to make this one happen. Right. I think the feeling for me, I wanted Aiden to have this experience because when I went to Clinton's impeachment, I felt like a range of emotions that I wouldn't have felt if I watched it on TV. It felt very solemn, and also like the seriousness of it is like feels present in the room in a way that I don't always get from watching the news.
Yeah. And Aiden, we know that you watch the news and listen to the news. What portion of it were you at?
So I believe we were there the first 30 minutes, around the first 30 minutes, where Schiff basically made his opening arguments.
This is Adam Schiff, yeah.
And then when we came back later for 90 minutes, it was near the middle of the day where all of the senators started to get a bit more irritated with the fact that they had to sit in those chairs for multiple hours.
But we watched a vote, a yay, nay vote.
Well, and just to hear all those names, Aiden, I can't imagine.
Oh, it was great.
Yeah. And we know that you went twice because you got the tickets because you knew you could contact your senator's office and there was a chance that you could get them there. And now I'm sure people across America are contacting their senator's offices as we speak.
Yes.
But you can also stand in line. Who'd you meet, Mary, when you stood in line? Who else was doing this?
We met a range of people. In the general line, we met people who had come as far away as Idaho and as close as Virginia, and many of them said that they were here just to witness history. We also saw some people who were protesters. They weren't allowed into the chamber. The gallery rules don't allow for any kind of a demonstration of approval or disapproval. Aiden, what's the phrase they say? On penalty
of pain of imprisonment.
Oh, boy.
Of pain of imprisonment.
Right. And they had T-shirts on or something.
So they did. Yeah, they had it said remove Trump, but each person had a letter, so it spelt those words.
Right. Well, Mary, when we were waiting to speak with you, we heard you talking to each other. and you were telling Aiden, your godson, now it's okay for you to don't be ironic, you know, don't be cynical because you're not about politics. But I would say to you as well, Mary, that you're an example of a difference an adult can make in a child's life, because I understand you took Aiden on a trip to D.C. when he was 8.
I did.
And you started this.
I started this problem.
you can light a fire in a young person.
I think that he's, not to credit myself too much, he's had some really strong teachers as well, but I think he's an example of how a young person can really view like the problems of the country as fixable. Mm-hmm. He has a sense of possibility in him that I don't see in many adults.
Yeah.
Robin, one thing, Aiden's in debate and mock trial, and one thing we talked about yesterday was watching this debate. And Aiden, what were your thoughts about that?
It was not a real debate. It was really up in the air, and it felt nobody really responded to each other's points in a legitimate, reasonable way. So it was not something I could watch and actually hear both sides fairly.
It didn't feel like a debate to you, who's on a debate team. But Aiden, you know, with that criticism, to be in that room, you know who sat in that room?
Yeah.
So reflect on that.
Seeing Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Lindsey Graham, Mitch McConnell, all these senators who I see on the television and read a lot about, seeing them in person and the way they act on and off the camera was just fascinating. And it makes me realize that, like, they're still human beings, but the way they act as senators impacts millions of Americans' lives.
Well, and if I were them, I'd be hearing, and a 14-year-old is watching.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I was the youngest in the room.
I think you were, too.
Yeah.
That's Aiden Hollinger-Miles, high school freshman from Oakland, California. We've also been speaking to his godmom, Mary Finn, former high school civics teacher from Oregon, both talking about watching the impeachment trial in the gallery yesterday. And remember, you can contact your senator's office or wait online and do the same. Aiden, Mary, thank you.
Thank you. Thank we really you. Appreciate the opportunity.
The world is complicated, but knowing the past can help us understand it so much better.
That's where we come in. I'm Rand Abdel-Fattah.
I'm Ramtin Arablouei, and we're the hosts of Throughline, NPR's history podcast.
Every week, we'll dig into forgotten stories from the moments that shaped our world.
Throughline from NPR. Listen and subscribe now.
And let's take a break from the politics and impeachment for a moment for our annual look at this year's Oscar nominees for Best Original Song. Joining us once again is John Burlingame, who writes about film music for Variety and teaches at USC's Thornton School of Music. Hi, John.
Jeremy, thanks for having me again.
Well, it's always great to have you, and I have to admit that I haven't been that great about watching the Oscar films, but maybe some of these songs will get me in the mood to watch one or two more in the next couple of weeks. Let's get to one of them, Randy Newman's I Can't Let You Throw Yourself Away. This is from Toy Story 4.
I can't let you, I can't let you, I can't let you throw yourself away. I can't let you. I can't let you,
I can't let you,
I can't let you throw yourself away. Don't you wanna see the sun come up each morning?
So I Can't Let You Throw Yourself Away is about the new Toy Story character Forky, the spork who does not see himself as a toy. What are your thoughts on this song?
You can't see me smiling here, but I'm thinking of the sequence in the movie, which is absolutely hysterical, because Forky literally keeps trying to throw himself away because he's a new toy. He was created from a spork, and he is somehow compelled to continue to try to dispose of himself. Randy is now nominated for his 21st and 22nd Oscars because he's up this year not only for song but for score for Marriage Story. It's a funny scene, and Randy's unique voice, I think, just adds to the humor. Whether this is Randy's year to win again, he's got two already, both for Pixar films.
Well, he won for the song We Belong Together from the previous Toy Story, in fact.
That's right, Toy Story 3, and he won another song for Monsters, Inc. Some years ago. Whether this is his year or not, I don't know. This is sort of the annual Randy Newman song nomination. He's pretty much automatically guaranteed one whenever there's a new one in the mix. And I think the Academy has a tendency to maybe take him a bit for granted.
Well, we'll see if they do again this year or not. The next song that we're going to hear, another nominee, is I'm Gonna Love Me Again. This is from the biopic Rocket Man about Elton John. This is performed by Elton John and the actor who plays him in the movie, Taron Egerton. Let's listen. So, like Randy Newman, Elton John has won an Oscar before for Can You Feel the Love Tonight from The Lion King, but this would be the first win for Elton's longtime collaborator, lyricist Bernie Taupin. Do you think it has a shot?
Well, this is not only, this is Bernie Taupin's first nomination ever. It was interesting at the Golden Globes when the two of them won that Elton John said that was the first thing they had ever won together in 52 years of songwriting. Which we all sort of ran scrambling to our statistical tallies to find out if it was true, and it apparently is. In the aftermath of the Globe win, I think this song actually has the momentum. It's far from a sure bet, but certainly there's a lot of momentum for this song. It's a very well-liked movie, Rocket Man. And if he were to win, Elton would sort of fall into a long line of Academy honors for huge pop stars. Mm-hmm. Bob Dylan, Bruce Springsteen, Phil Collins, all of these later in their careers won Academy Awards, and I would not be surprised to see Elton and Bernie win.
Well, and it would also sort of feel like a Lifetime Achievement Award because he's ending touring now.
Exactly, yeah. And that's why I say I think there's a strong shot here for mm-hmm. this song from Rocket Man to win.
Okay, there was one that wasn't nominated, and I want to come to that now, especially because we were just talking about The Lion King. Beyoncé's song Spirit from last year's version of The Lion King. Listen to this. Was this omission a surprise?
My guess is that this finished sixth in the balloting.
Huh.
You can't, you know, ignore the presence of a huge superstar like Beyoncé. And Spirit, I think, is a good song. It's not very well used in the movie itself, and the movie itself was not as well liked as Disney, I think, expected it to be. So I think that that may be why it finished. It's just under the wire in the balloting.
Okay, well, one that was nominated is I'm Standing With You from the movie Breakthrough. This is performed by Chrissy Metz, the film's star.
Through whatever you go through, I'm standing with you. And wherever you go to, I'll stand beside. Think that all the odds are all against you, and you just feel like giving up. Well, I won't let you.
John, this song is written by Diane Warren. This is her 11th Oscar nomination, but she's never won. Could this be her year?
Well, it could be. If the Academy wants to reward Diane, who has been active in songwriting for more than 30 years in Hollywood, if they want to reward her at long last, this is her shot. I think the problem with this particular nomination is that the movie Breakthrough was very little seen. The nomination was clearly for Diane. And you got to remember that the nominations are chosen by the music branch, about 300 members in the music branch. But the entire Academy gets to vote for every single category in the final tally. So the question then becomes, did they see the movie? Do they know the song? Mm-hmm. And I think that makes this one a real dark horse for a win.
Okay. If I were to say to our listeners the names Robert Lopez, Kristen Anderson Lopez, and Idina Menzel, I wonder if they would know that those are the three behind the 2014 Best Song winner from Frozen, Let It Go. Well, they are nominated again this year with Into the Unknown from Frozen 2. Here it is.
I've had my adventure. I don't need something new. I am afraid of what I'm risking if I follow you into the unknown. Into the unknown. Into the unknown.
So can Into the Unknown do what Let It Go did?
Well, it's hard to say. And the reason I hedge on this one is that Frozen 2, surprisingly, was not nominated for Best Animated Feature, which many of us expected it to be. So what does that mean? Does that mean that the Academy as a whole wasn't crazy about it, didn't see it, wasn't that interested? So it's interesting. This is, of course, another big Idina Menzel number, and it's a key dramatic moment in the film, where Elsa is drawn into the enchanted forest to find her destiny. Bobby and Kristen not only wrote Let It Go, but they also wrote Remember Me and for Coco a couple of years ago, and so they have two Oscars already. I just don't know. It's hard to say because, let's face it, this is not as powerful or a sort of world-shaking anthem as was Let It Go, but it's still a really good song in the movie. We'll see.
Okay, the last song is called Stand Up. This is from Harriet, the film about Harriet Tubman, co-written here by Cynthia Erivo and Joshua Brian Campbell and performed by Erivo. Let's listen.
While the clouds roll back and the stars fill the night, that's when I'm gonna stand up, take my can feel it in my bones.
Now, John, Cynthia Erivo is also nominated for Best Actress for her performance in Harriet. Last year, we remember Lady Gaga had the same double nomination. She won the Best Song Oscar for Shallow, which she co-wrote and performed in A Star is Born. Do you think Cynthia Erivo can do the same?
Yes, she may well do the same. I think you cannot count this song out. She not only stars as Harriet Tubman, but she, as you point out, co-wrote the song and sings it. It's a great song in that there are gospel influences here. It's got a bit of an R&B feel, somewhat contemporary, and yet it links perfectly to the movie. I think it has a real shot if voters don't automatically check off the Elton John song. And her double nomination, I think, says something. Mm-hmm. If she doesn't win Best Actress, and I think that's a bit of a long shot, there's a real strong possibility here that Erivo could take home the Best Song Oscar.
But if she wins either Best Actress or Best Song, she will have an EGOT, the Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, Tony thing that very few people have.
You know, it's interesting. The voters are generally not aware of those kinds of things, at least the Academy at large. Unless it's a real superstar. And so that's an interesting case. And does that mean that she has a better shot? Because people say, oh, well, let's give her the EGOT. I don't know about that.
I mean, I feel like at least she must know she has an EGT right now, and she might be soon having an EGOT.
Yes, I'm sure.
Yes. That is John Burlingame, who writes for Variety and teaches at USC's Thornton School of Music, talking with us about the nominees for Best Song at the Oscars, which will be on February the 9th. John, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And we've been following the story of the group Moms for Housing, the homeless mothers who occupied a vacant Oakland, California property for nearly 2 months with support from protesters. Well, earlier this week, they reached an agreement to purchase the home through a community land trust. But it's not the first time people have prevailed after taking over a home in Oakland to protest displacement. Molly Solomon of KQED reports.
Someone bought that one. Someone's lost that one.
Gayla Newsom points to different houses on her block on Adeline Street. She says it's not unusual to meet people who have fallen behind on their mortgage and ended up in foreclosure.
At least half the houses in this complex have been lost.
Including hers. Nearly a decade ago, she lost the cream-colored two-story townhouse we're standing in front of. But Newsom did something extraordinary. She won it back through public protest.
Everybody knows this as the Occupy House.
Newsom originally bought it in 1997 for $150,000, but things started to unravel around the economic downturn. She lost her job at running a local nonprofit. She got divorced. Her two older daughters were both in college. So Newsom decided she needed to take out a second loan.
And I got behind on that second loan. And so the second lender placed a foreclosure.
The home was auctioned off to an investor, and she was evicted. Around the same time, the Occupy movement began taking over homes lost to foreclosure. Newsom heard about it and got in touch with advocates, including ACE Action, the group that has been working recently with Moms for Housing. And she made a decision. She was going to do whatever it took to move back in.
And I said, I've got to take that risk because I've got to get my house back.
The occupation took months. Similar to Moms for Housing, the movement swelled with supporters.
So whenever anybody, a mayor, law enforcement, anybody like that ever showed up, somebody hit the phone tree and there was like a human barrier.
and organizers began to take on the banks. They shut down the branch of Chase Bank, where Newsom had her mortgage, and activists flew to San Diego to protest outside the office of the second lender. And to the CEO of that lender, Newsom made her own personal plea.
I put it all in a letter to him to explain my total situation. And when I wrote him the personal letter, they took the second loan off, basically.
She eventually got the deed back and is once again the rightful owner of her house. But she says the fight was bigger than just her.
This is for my entire West Oakland community.
Over time, her block has changed. Her black and brown neighbors have been priced out. Her house is now estimated on Zillow for nearly $700,000. Most of the other homes here are going for even more.
This is a million-dollar block now, and that's what's going on in this community. That's what's going on.
Less than a mile away is 2928 Magnolia Street, the house occupied recently by homeless moms.
When I first heard about it, I was like, wow.
Newsom met the moms shortly before they were evicted. She says while their stories aren't identical, they strike a similar chord. They're stories of the trauma and pain of eviction, of seeing your hometown change.
So people like myself, people like Moms for Housing, that's that voice. Those people finally have a voice.
A voice, she says, for people who are fighting every day to stay in Oakland. For Here and Now, I'm Molly Solomon.
With 12 days to go before the Iowa caucuses, the impeachment trial is keeping Senators Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Amy Klobuchar, and Michael Bennett in Washington and mostly off the campaign trail, as Sanders takes the lead nationally for the first time, according to a new poll out today from CNN. Joining us now, NPR political correspondent Scott Detrow. Hi, Scott.
Hey, good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. And Bernie Sanders had to cancel a rally at the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls yesterday because of the impeachment trial. But he'll be back in Iowa this weekend campaigning with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Is this impeachment trial, which is keeping, as we said, several senators off the trail, going to have a big impact on the campaign, do you think?
I think it will. It's hard to say. I think of the candidates, Bernie Sanders is probably the best positioned to make it work, and that's for a few reasons. First of all, he has a ton of money, consistently raising the most money of all the candidates for president. He's able to air a lot of ads. He's able to, you know, among other things, get himself to Iowa and back if there are breaks in the schedule quickly, able to, you know, get the resources to do that. He has high-profile surrogates like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez who can go and draw huge crowds and get the supporters fired up to go knock on doors and do the organizing that's needed. I think what we don't know is for things like say, Amy Klobuchar, right? She just gets this big semi-endorsement from the New York Times, and for a candidate who's in the mid-single digits like she is, that's a big deal. Mm-hmm. She did not have the opportunity to go out and hold a rally the next day and say, look, I got a bigger crowd here. I've got momentum growing, right? She was stuck in Washington, D.C. So I think it's things like that. It's the not having the chance to show momentum or things like that that could be the problem.
Well, what about the candidates in the top tier who don't have to worry about the impeachment trial because they're not in the Senate, and that would be Joe Biden and Pete Buttigieg. What are they doing during the trial?
Well, I think they're very happy to not be sitting on the Senate floor until 2 a.m. like all of their competitors
silently.
Are. Yeah, silently. I was in the chamber for a while yesterday watching the body language of the candidates, and it's really hard to pick up much other than the fact that, oh, Amy Klobuchar is writing notes. Bernie Sanders isn't. I mean, obviously, they're getting on TV as much as they can from the trial, but Biden and Buttigieg are doing what most candidates do in the final weeks before a contest, and that's campaigning as much as possible. And their campaigns are very happy not to have to deal with this scheduling nightmare.
Are they sticking in Iowa for the most part?
Yes. Buttigieg is really doing a ton of Iowa events. He'll pop over to New Hampshire a little bit, but by and large, he is focused almost entirely on Iowa. His path forward runs through winning or placing very well in the Iowa caucuses.
Michael Bloomberg is running one national ad right now focusing on Trump's impeachment. Listen to this.
It's time for the Senate to act and remove Trump from office. And if they won't do their jobs this November, you and I will.
How does Mike Bloomberg's campaign get affected by the impeachment trial?
I'm not really sure it does. I think he's already running an incredibly non-traditional campaign of ignoring the first four early states and basically running a national general election ad campaign, hundreds of millions of dollars in states all across the country that don't vote for months. I think the big question a lot of Democrats have is what Mike Bloomberg's end goal is if he does not end up as the Democratic nominee. Is he going to continue to spend this amount of money trying to attack President Trump and boost the eventual nominee? He says he's going to, and the fact that he shifted gears this week with these ads putting pressure on moderate Republicans, I think that ad was mostly running in states with moderate Republicans, is a sign that he seems more interested in the moment, or certainly very interested in defeating Donald Trump, and will spend his endless resources to do that.
Let's talk about this new poll out today from CNN that has Sanders for the first time in the lead nationally. Now, it's a national poll. It's not about the early states. But what does that tell you?
Well, I'll add that we have since gotten another national poll from Monmouth University that has Joe Biden in the lead. But both of those show the same thing we've been seeing in a lot of contests, and that there continues to be a gap between Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders and then the rest of the field, even among Warren and Buttigieg, who've for a while now been part of that top tier of four candidates outpolling everybody else. I think you have seen Bernie Sanders really consolidate his strength on the left end of the party recently. He seems to be drawing some support from Elizabeth Warren more recently, and he is in a very strong position right now. You know, I mentioned before, he has consistently outraised all the other candidates. He's got a lot of resources to run a national campaign, and I think he and Biden look pretty strong right now. Of course, national polls will change very quickly once we see the results of Iowa. And poll after poll after poll in Iowa shows a very tight bunch among those four candidates there.
Okay, well, there is something else going on with Bernie Sanders, which is that he's gotten into trouble both in an argument at the debate with Elizabeth Warren, but now with Hillary Clinton, who came out.
I don't know
if
you would call this trouble, but
well,
yes.
Okay, well, I mean, maybe it's trouble, maybe it's not trouble, but she says nobody likes Bernie Sanders. She dismissed him and his movement in 2016, and she at first wouldn't say in this Hulu documentary that's coming out soon whether she'd endorse Sanders if he's the nominee. Does this kind of thing make Democrats nervous, this fighting within the party?
I think fighting within the party makes Democrats nervous. I'm not sure how much of an influence Hillary Clinton is having on voters who are trying to make up their minds in 2020. I will note the last time that she criticized another candidate, she criticized Tulsi Gabbard a couple months ago. Tulsi Gabbard actually saw her poll numbers go notably up in New Hampshire and in a couple other polls. Bernie Sanders seemed to try to sidestep this the other day. He joked in the Senate, you know, on a good day, his wife likes him and he's okay with that.
He also, though, in terms of fighting within the party, on CBS, he apologized to Joe Biden for one of Sanders' surrogates' opinion piece calling out Biden for corruption because he takes big money political donations. Listen to this.
It is absolutely not my view that Joe is corrupt in any way. And I'm sorry that op-ed appeared to me.
I mean, Scott, there is a sense from some after what happened a few years ago that Sanders needs to keep his supporters fired up about whoever the Democratic nominee is if it's not him.
Yeah, but in between now and then, there is a contest to decide who that nominee is. And I think the fact that we have made such a big deal over these couple blips of candidates criticizing each other is notable because, by and large, this field has not gone after each other that much. Mm-hmm. Sanders and Biden are sparring over the future of Social Security right now. They've, of course, had big differences on the Iraq War. But you have not really seen candidates go directly at each other, full throttle, negative ads like you have in so many other primaries. And I think that's pretty notable so close to actual contests happening.
Joe Biden did an interview with MSNBC's Morning Joe, and part of the interview is getting a lot of attention. Biden teared up talking about his son. Let's listen.
Joe, Bo should be the one running for president, not me. Every morning I get up, Joe, not a joke, I think to myself, is he proud of me?
Scott, what do you make of that? He's talking about his son, Bo, who died of cancer.
I mean, I think one of the reasons why Joe Biden is held in such high regard by so many Democratic voters and has those high approval ratings and has such a long track record of support is that vulnerability when he's so open about it, talking about not just his son Beau's death, but a lot of tragedies that have struck his family over the year, losing other children as well. And he is not only upfront about it, but he seems to have a mission of reaching out to people who've had similar grief in their lives. And I think that's something that really makes Biden appealing to a lot of Democratic voters, even those who might be ready to vote or caucus for another candidate.
One more candidate I want to ask you about is Tulsi Gabbard, who filed a defamation lawsuit against Hillary Clinton today for characterizing Tulsi Gabbard as a Russian asset. Is Gabbard gaining any momentum, especially in New Hampshire? She's done better than in other states?
I'm not sure. I think that, I referenced this earlier. I think one of the moments where Tulsi Gabbard got some of the most attention she's gotten in recent months was when she was going back and forth with Hillary Clinton over those comments. So this seemed to be viewed by a lot of people as an attempt to try and bring that storyline back into the news and get some attention, because otherwise Tulsi Gabbard has not really been in the thrust of the conversation in these final weeks in Iowa and New Hampshire.
If Biden wins in Iowa, which is a possibility, do you think that it's going to be a short period of time before we know who the nominee is?
I am embracing the fact that I have no idea what's going to happen in any of these states. And I think, I'm just going to stay there and be surprised by what happens. I mean, I think Joe Biden winning Iowa could affect the race more than anyone else winning Iowa.
Well, we will be in Iowa. I will be in Iowa next Thursday and Friday. We'll be hosting the show from there. Robin will be in New Hampshire right before the New Hampshire primary. So stay tuned for that. Scott Detrow, covering the 2020 presidential campaign for NPR. Thank you.
See you in Iowa.
Yes, we're swimming in a news stream, the impeachment trial, but a person has to eat, so we're taking a moment to consider fish with our resident chef, Kathy Gunst. In some parts of the country, when they can't get fresh caught, people are wary of fish in winter, and Kathy says you shouldn't be. Winter fish are a thing.
There's absolutely all kinds of fish that are special in the winter, but there's more to it than that. I talked to Barton Seaver, who I call a seafood evangelist. Mm-hmm. This man has written many books on seafood. And I said to him, so Barton, tell me about winter fish. And he talked about the East Coast. There's harbor pollock, there's skate, there's monkfish, scallops, smelts. On the West Coast, that beautiful sweet Dungeness crab and Pacific rockfish. And he went on. But then he kind of blew my mind. He said, let's talk about frozen seafood. And I'm like, wait, you're like the seafood guru and you want to talk about frozen seafood? So he told me that there have been enormous technological advances in freezing seafood. And the perception has completely changed about what frozen means. We're not talking fish sticks here.
Right.
I grew up with those.
Every Friday.
Fishermen and women are now investing in equipment to have at sea. They're freezing at lower temperatures, so there's no frosty coating on it. Their processing and freezing technology has just come a long, long way. It's lower costs, lower waste, and cheaper to transport. So I thought that was super interesting. He also talked about smoked fish. Think of smoked salmon, all the wonderful smoked trout you can find. But I thought, oh, that's such a good idea to use smoked fish in the winter. So I created a soup. This is a Scottish-style smoked haddock and leek chowder. And what you do, I love this recipe, because you take a smoked haddock fillet, which you often can find in the freezer section of a good fish store, and you put it in some milk with a bay leaf and an onion and some peppercorns, and you let it simmer. And what happens is that the smoky haddock infuses the milk. Then you strain that milk and use it as the basis of the chowder. It's a wonderful, wintry, comforty chowder.
I can attest. By the way, do we smoke our own fish, or do you not recommend that?
No. I mean, if you have a smoker at home, you could smoke fish quite easily, particularly an oily fish where there's going to be a little bit of fat and oil so that it'll smoke and not dry out.
Okay. All right. Well, yeah, you say frozen fish. So what are we thinking about there?
Well, so that also kind of blew my mind. Like, really? This guy's talking about frozen fish. So I went to my local seafood store, and there, lo and behold, was some beautiful red snapper fillets in the freezer section. And I thought, is this going to be good? Like, really? And it was incredibly fresh. Tasted like it had been caught yesterday. Snapper's a wild-caught American fish. It's sustainably managed. I lightly dredged it in flour with salt and pepper, and then I heated some olive oil and butter really hot and sautéed the fish, flipped it over, added some capers and blood orange juice. Mm. Blood orange is in season all winter long. They're those beautiful maroon-fleshed and super sweet oranges. You could use a regular orange as well. And then a little bit of capers and brown butter. And honestly, Robin, 10 minutes.
Okay.
Would you ever know that that was frozen?
No, it's delicious.
Okay.
But the tinned fish.
Yes. I wanted to focus on anchovies, which I am passionate about. Very oily fish, rich in omega-3 fatty acids, found all over the Mediterranean. To me, this is the best canned food in the whole world. It's salty. It's aggressive. And what I did, I went to a restaurant in South Boston called Fox and the Knife, and they had a salad called Broccoli Caesar. And it was so delicious, I thought, I'm going to try to recreate it. They grilled it, but what I did was I took a cast iron skillet, put some olive oil in, let it get searingly hot, thinly sliced my broccoli so you can see those beautiful brown marks on it. Let it get almost tender. And then you make a very quick sauce in a blender with miso, anchovies, anchovy oil, and lemon juice. And crisscross some anchovy fillets on top. Boy, this will wake up any winter palate, any winter cooking. You've got the beautiful green broccoli and then this pow of flavor.
This is almost too much flavor. I mean, it's
for you.
I'm loving it, but it's
a wake up.
It's, yeah.
Oh. It is. Anchovies are assertive. I'm telling you, there's no way around it. But you can cut back on them a little bit too. But I can't get enough of them on pizza. I put them in Caesar salads. I throw them into sauces.
Is there, you know, for people who think they can't do anchovies, is there a way they're maybe doing them wrong?
Well, it's just for some people, they call it too fishy. I say don't even think about it that way. It's almost its own food group. That's how much I love them.
Mm-mm-mm. Any other suggestions? Again, winter fish or fish in the winter.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you've got to look and ask what's local. South Carolinas are bringing in porgy. Mackerel comes out of the Gulf of Mexico. Mullet in the south. And then on the East Coast in the winter, I look for those little smelts, saute those, coat them in a little cornmeal. Simple, simple winter cooking.
Okay. We have been talking winter fish with Here and Now resident chef Kathy Guntz. And again, we'll have all of these recipes at hereandnow.org. They are amazing. Kathy, thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. And now we know what we can eat while listening to the impeachment trial.
It smells.
It's Here Now.